WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is playwright Arthur Miller. There are continual revivals of his 1949 Pulitzer Prize-winning play Death of a Salesman about the self-deluding salesman Willie Loman. Dustin Hoffman and John Malkovich recently starred in a TV production. In 1983, Miller traveled to China for the premiere of the Beijing People's Theater production of Death of a Salesman. Miller's other plays include All My Sons, The Crucible, After the Fall, and A View from the Bridge. He also wrote the screenplay for the film The Misfits, which starred Marilyn Monroe, to whom he was briefly married. At the age of 72, Miller has written his autobiography. It's titled Time Bends. I spoke to Arthur Miller earlier today from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. Over the years, many people have told him that Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman reminded them of their fathers. I asked Miller if Loman was based on his father.
Oh, no, my father was quite a different fellow. It was rather based on a group, maybe, of people, including myself. But my father was a far more realistic person than Willie Loman.
Did you have relatives who were salesmen?
Many, yeah, and friends. And it seems to me the whole United States is engaged in selling. But as it turns out, over the years, most of the world recognizes what's at the bottom of that idea, namely that Willie is trying to become great. Without being great, and which is what most of us are doing or dreaming about doing. So the selling part of it is rather minimally significant, I would think.
Your father made a lot of money in the 20s in the coat business, and then he lost a lot of that money during the Depression. Did that sudden turnaround in your family's fate stay with you? Did you always feel through your life that any good luck that came along could quickly be undermined by bad luck?
Well, it's even worse than luck. Luck is arbitrary. The idea in the Depression was that bad times were not arbitrary, they were inevitable. And this was the common wisdom of the time, that the country had reached some kind of an end to a what was thought to be an unbroken rising line starting back in the American Revolution, maybe. None of us was particularly interested in remembering that there had been other depressions. Of course, there was never one that widespread and that profound and that long-lasting.
Your father was in business. I think some of your uncles were in business. You became a playwright. Were you determined to stay out of the business world?
Well, it was determined for me since I never could add very well or multiply or subtract. And if you don't do those things, you can't be in business. And my temperament was completely opposite to a businessman's temperament. I could easily be distracted by some entertaining idea or something that amused me. And businessmen have to be very disciplined people. They have to put out of their minds everything that's really interesting and stick with money-making, which I could do for maybe 5 minutes, but not longer. So it was determined beforehand that I would never be in business.
In your autobiography, you wrote that you really learned a lot about casting, watching Ilya Kazan interview actors for your play All My Sons. What did you learn from the way he went about casting for that play?
Well, it's a little bit, I suppose the analogy is a clinical psychologist, in fact. At the time, he knew how to evince from an actor whose work he didn't know reactions to questions which would show whether he had a sense of humor, for example, whether he was ironical, whether he was able to relax. Now, as it turned out, of course, most of the casting of the major parts in that play were people who he'd seen act before or knew as a member of the group theater. And so we were basically looking for the young woman in the play who was required a lot of interviews. He was able to form a subjective and objective impression rather quickly. And I think that was very cute on his part.
You wrote that during a rehearsal, Kazan pressed Carl Malden to his emotional limits. Well, what exactly did he do to push him like that? And
well,
why did he do it?
He wanted indignation and anger, and he wanted him to come on at a full pitch. In other words, not come on and gradually build up some kind of anger, but have it off stage before he got there. And Carl, being a very willing fellow, kept steaming himself up off stage and getting furious at something or other, and finally charged onto the stage and stood there swaying, and he'd managed to get himself so dizzy that he was near collapse, and had to sit and had to sit down in the middle of this anger and ask for help. These were tactics that I'm sure have been used before and since, but they were interesting for me for the first time.
Writer Arthur Miller is my guest. He's just written an autobiography titled Time Bends. Now, about Death of a Salesman, you write that you think it was frequently played with too much empathy, not enough irony and distance. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it wasn't that it was played that way. It was that the play was a tremendous shock to that audience, I believe. And it still is in some productions. But they weren't at all prepared for it. And my reaction was that I, after a few weeks of watching, occasionally I'd drop into the theater once a week or so to see how it was going. I wanted simply to write a tougher play because the times were changing. And as 1950 was coming around. And I wanted to confront people with stuff that I saw in the society which was being ignored. And I came up with The Crucible, finally, which was a much harder-edged play. It's not that I didn't want to move people, but I wanted them to keep their awareness intact as to what Willie's failures were as a human being, and not simply to go down with him in a veil of tears. I was mistaken somewhat, I think, because people did understand far more than I gave them credit for at the time.
I read somewhere that several corporations invited you to speak to their sales managers after Death of a Salesman opened.
Yeah, I was supposed to be a sales expert. Of course, I've never sold anything. I don't know how I would start to do it. And I managed to turn down those invitations, although had I had more chutzpah, I probably should have done it.
To tell them just what?
Well, I should have addressed these salesmen and told them how to do it so that they could commit suicide later. But it was that silly. But I managed not to do it. I should add, I don't know why it crosses my mind, that, you know, in China now, I was just talking to a newspaper correspondent who had just come back a few days ago. And salesman plays there all the time. And I asked him whether they had gotten used to it now, because when I did it a couple of years ago there, it was a bombshell. They'd never seen a play like that. And he said, well, now all the enterprises in China, a lot of them now are new, and they're set up by individuals. And there, he said, there are hundreds of salesmen all over the place. China is one mass of salesmanship now. They're running from one place to another, selling each other stuff. And So the play has now become part of their problem as to how to make life real. You see, when there's a surplus and you have to sell it, life becomes a little bit metaphorical and loses its touch with the earth.
Yeah.
And I guess it's the cost of technology.
You were married to Marilyn Monroe for several years. The first time you met her, you described her in your book as being ludicrously provocative. I think about what an unusual couple that you made, you the intellectual playwright and she the sex goddess. Did you think of yourselves as kind of balancing each other in a way?
Well, we were in effect, you could say, unifying two sides of humanity, if you want to use some highfalutin language. I didn't see her as a sex goddess anyway. She wasn't one then. She became one after her death, basically, and in the last few years of her life. But early on, she was just a young woman trying to get a job as an actress and trying to improve herself as an actress. So she was hardly a goddess. She was powerless, if truth were known.
Well, you told her that you thought she was the saddest girl that you'd ever known, and she said that you were the only person who'd ever said that about her. What made you say that?
Well, I just sensed that she had very deep problems and that she was basically in mourning for something. Of course, in our terms today, Marilyn was an abused child, and a badly abused child. And as we know now, such people carry their wounds through their lives. And in some cases, they get worse as they grow older.
You wrote the screenplay for The Misfits, in which Marilyn Monroe co-starred with Clark Gables, directed by John Huston. She had been studying with Lee Strasberg, and you thought that the acting lessons she was taking from him were becoming a bad influence on her. It was encouraging her to improvise in the script of The Misfits, and you thought that that wasn't good. Would you explain?
Well, Strasberg's view was that, at least as Marilyn understood it, and I think she understood what he was saying to her, was that the words were far less important than the emotion that the actor brought to the moment. So this led people to misunderstand that the language on the page, like the notes that a musician has to play, were the vehicles for his emotion. As a consequence, it wasn't just Marilyn, it was a number of other actors that I've had to deal with in the past, would scramble around searching, groping for words that they should have easily been able to handle. And meantime, were trying to maintain an emotional life at the same moment. This makes it doubly difficult. Instead of absorbing the words and forgetting about them, they never did learn them. They were in revolt against the words. And, of course, when you asked them, it wasn't, again, not merely Marilyn, but many others, what are you going to do when you do Chekhov, where everybody knows the speeches? Or, for that matter, if you're going to do Death of a Salesman, in which everybody knows the speeches, are you going to improvise new speeches? Well, there was never a satisfactory answer to this, and I found it was a very misleading way of directing actors. I thought it was perverse.
Well, with Marilyn Monroe and The Misfits, it must have been especially aggravating to you because, A, you were married, and B, it was your screenplay that she was improvising on.
Well, no, it wasn't that. It's that it holds everything up. You cannot improvise that way. I have one actor improvising and everybody else sticking to the script, obviously. The other actors are waiting for their cues. And if the cue doesn't come, they are inconvenienced, aren't they? How do they know when to speak?
You've written about Marilyn Monroe that she saw men as boys with immediate needs that it was her place to fill. That made me think about the the kind of jealousy you must have had to control when you were married to her, since
it... Not at all. I didn't feel anything like that.
The only other question I wanted to ask you was what the relationship taught you about real life versus movie life, or the difficulties of life in the spotlight in America.
Well, we tend to exploit people in the movies and to make them into non-human figures. And it's a form of disrespect, actually, for the most part, but it's disguised. Since we don't know, for the most part, a good actor from a bad one, it all becomes a question of personalities. And the art, whether it be the art of acting or the art of directing or anything else, goes by the boards for the most part. There are better views than that now, I think, than there used to be. There are more better-equipped critics in the movies now than there used to be. But this whole thing is, this personality cult is a cheap and easy way to get out of having to make any kind of aesthetic judgments.
My guest is Arthur Miller. He's written a new autobiography titled Time Bends. Arthur Miller's plays include Death of a Salesman, All My Sons, and The Crucible. We'll talk some more about his life and about theater after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Arthur Miller is my guest. You were called to testify before UAC, the House on American Activities Committee. And it's interesting to me, you didn't take the Fifth. You refused to answer questions about other people and about whether they were communists or not, or whether they attended certain meetings. But you didn't take the Fifth like some people did who didn't want to respond to the committee. And I was wondering what your strategy was, how you conceived of your strategy.
Well, by the time I was called, certain... standards had been forced upon the committee by the courts, particularly that they were not supposed to be calling people without cause. Previously, they could simply pick you out of your studio and decide that you were going to go in front of the committee if they thought there was some publicity to be gained from it. And they need give no reason for calling you, excepting a perfectly rhetorical one. Now, as a result of various cases that had been fought and won, particularly by Joseph Rao, my lawyer, who had been the head of the American for Democratic Action, and a strong fighter for civil liberties, they had to provide you might call it a pretext, or it could be a genuine reason for calling a person. I should add that a day before I was to testify in Washington, the chairman of the committee, Congressman Walter of Pennsylvania, had my lawyer contacted and was informed that if Marilyn Monroe would take a photograph with him, he would cancel the hearing. When that was refused by me and Marilyn, he proceeded to paint me as an imminent danger to the Republic. The cynicism of this whole thing is breathtaking.
You had some friends who did name names to the House Un-American Activities Committee, and one of your good friends who named names was Ilya Kazan. Now, he told you he was just confirming names, that he wasn't offering new names, but how did you react to his cooperation, and were you ever able to become close again after whatever separation that difference caused?
Well, I was... like a lot of other people, we had positioned ourselves in opposition to the committee. And when he did that, I was shocked, and I couldn't work with him for a while, for some years. For, as a matter of fact, let's see, that would have been all about 7 years.
In 1965, you accepted the chairmanship of the International PEN Organization, P-E-N, which is the International
Right.
Organization of Writers. Were you inspired to do that because... Well, why were you inspired to accept that position, which I know would take away time from your writing?
Well, quite simply, the organization was foundering, as it was presented to me by the British, who were the center of the organization at that time, and to a degree still are. And they needed somebody whose name was known and who would show that live writers with real typewriters were interested in the organization. And what the organization was primarily about at that time was to try to save people in the Eastern European dictatorships, which it was managing to do in a faltering way because it did not have at that time the support of all the Western writers. And I took it over, and I'm glad to say that the organization in a few years became extremely active and attracted a lot of wonderful people in it and is now a very strong organization with a big American membership and does a hell of a job with preserving the rights of writers all over the world.
In 1986, you went to the Soviet Union, and there you met Mikhail Gorbachev, who shook hands with you and said to you, "I know all of your plays." But you've said that your plays have been censored during a period in the Soviet Union. Which was that period, and which plays were censored?
In 68, they had a production in rehearsal of Incident of Vichy, which is a play about the Jews in southern France during World War II. And the night before it was to open to the public, it was closed down by the government. It was part of the Brezhnev time, I guess. And they were having trouble, as they put it, with the Jews then. But it was also that I was, by that time, had become very vociferous in criticizing certain treatment they were meeting out to writers. So that I became a stinker for, well, it's till about last year, in fact, from 68. And that same production, Things Move Slowly in Russia, reopened about 8 months ago. And is running in Moscow now of Incident of Vichy. So it was a matter of roughly 9 years that my stuff was not done in Russia.
Do you go to Broadway much anymore? Do you go to many shows?
Not much, but I never did go very much. Unfortunately, Broadway now has practically ruled out any kind of straight plays, whether they're acceptable to the critics or not. The audience has been dispersed, which was perfectly predictable. Indeed, in 52, I was then a member of the board of the Dramatists Guild, and I tried to create a conference between the producers, the directors, the actors, the scene movers and builders and so forth, and the writers, to try to get everybody to take a little less money so that we could save and reduce the price of the ticket, because I felt we were slowly but surely going to block out the teacher, the student, the gut of the audience that was possible in New York City. Well, nobody was really that interested enough to do anything about it, and we never did anything about it. And now, effectively, they have knocked those people out of the audience. So how this will ever be cured, I don't know. I don't think it is yet taken seriously enough. They still go on saying that if a good play comes along and it's a hit, they're going to make a lot of money on it. And, of course, once in a while this happens, and it's enough to justify the idea that nothing is fundamentally askew. The thing is sick. It's been getting ill for years, and the basic problems are well known, but nobody's interested enough to do anything about them. Namely, that we have one newspaper in New York that matters as far as it is concerned, so it's all but a monopoly. There is no consensus of critical opinion. Two, the price of the ticket is high because of greed in part, and partly because it's totally chaotic in its organization. And finally, there has been no effort to organize an audience. An audience doesn't just show up for play, or it just has to, people have to be somehow drawn to the theater. I repeat that the Lincoln Center is trying to do that, and they have to a degree succeeded. But of course, you can get in there for less than $10. And they contact students, they contact faculties, they try to engage the public in the theater as a cultural event instead of simply appealing to the people as another form of television so that they can cast plays with good actors, not necessarily television stars. People are now going to Broadway shows because there is a star. It's always the sign of a decayed theater when that happens.
Can I just ask you really briefly what you thought of the television production of the Dustin Hoffman, John Malkovich production of Death of a Salesman?
I thought it was a very fine... that play is very difficult to put on film. We haven't time here to discuss some of the metaphysics involved, because it is a kind of metaphysical problem. But they came as close as you could come, I think, to solving some of those problems. And I thought it was a very moving performance.
We only have a few seconds. Let me just ask you this kind of quickly. You once said that, Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman says, I still feel kind of temporary about myself. And you once said that summed up your condition through life. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. It's that I'm open to tomorrow morning. I don't feel settled in any way. I think that it's very difficult in the 20th century to continue feeling if you think everything is foreclosed. Life is open-ended. Anything can happen. And I wouldn't say prepared for it, but I'm sort of looking over my shoulder. In that sense, temporary about myself, yes. Life goes on developing even when you get to be an ancient mariner like me. It's different from year to year, month to month.
Well, Arthur Miller, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been playwright Arthur Miller. His new autobiography, Time Bends, has just been published by Grove Press. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.